Welcome back to Disclaimers Aside, a bi-weekly podcast where I share the stories of people in my community, Disclaimers Aside. I'm your host, Aisara Amadou, and let's dive into this week's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Disclaimers Aside. I am officially back at campus, and this is my first week of spring semester. I actually had my first day of classes yesterday, and I got back into Berkeley the day before. Spring semester has been a great start. I feel like I'm coming into the semester just really excited with a lot of renewed energy. I feel like the new year always helps make spring semester feel like a fresh start. I feel like spring semester is always really fun on campus just because Ramadan happens to fall during spring semester, which is always such a fun experience, especially being a Muslim on campus. It's a time where the Muslim community really comes together. A lot of the cultural orgs have their like culture shows and things towards the end of the semester, which is really, really fun. And then of course there's like graduation season and all of the festivities that come with that, which I'm really, really excited about. But this is the start of my last semester of undergrad. And so I'm definitely going into this semester with a little bit of bittersweet feelings. I'm like, on the one hand, excited to graduate and move on to the next chapter of my life. On the other hand, you know, just trying to cling on to every last experience of college that I have, because I know I'm not going to be able to come back to this time. Like, nothing is going to be like undergrad. Even if you keep studying and you go on to get your master's or your doctorate, or you go on to some other postgraduate study program, the vibe of the college experience, of the American undergrad college experience, is just not like any other experience. And so really trying to just enjoy what left I have of it, because I'm not going to get this time back. I am really just kind of going into the semester with the mindset of trying to live in the moment and trying to just be present in this last semester. And I'm also just trying to also say yes to as much as possible. I don't want to look back on my college experience feeling a sense of regret that I wish I had done something or I had said yes to an opportunity. That's really the energy that I'm going into this new semester with. I need to sit down and have like a little session where I set my semester goals. I recommend everyone set goals special to the semester, like aside from New Year's goals. I think setting semester goals is really, really important and just a great way to just make sure that you're taking the most out of each and every semester in college. I do want to share my rec of the week. I'm actually really excited to share this one. So it's a book that I've been reading called 101 Essays That Will Change the Way You Think by Brianna West. So I actually heard about this book on Kenna Marie's channel. She was vlogging and she was mentioning that she was listening to this audiobook and that it's free if you have an Audible subscription, which I do have an Audible subscription, so I immediately added it to my library. I started listening to it actually in the car when I was driving back down from LA when we dropped off my sister with my dad. Basically, this book is just a bunch of essays on very, very niche subjects that really just kind of are written in a way to kind of unlearn a lot of the things or a lot of the ways that we think that may be holding ourselves back in different ways in our lives. I'm about an hour into this audiobook and have really, really been enjoying it a lot. I think the audiobook is a great way to consume it, but I also think having like a physical copy and like actually being able to highlight and annotate might also be a really great way to listen to it. I feel like if you're someone who loves to listen to podcasts and you're trying to get into audiobooks and just reading more in the new year, this is like a great one to listen to, just because you can just listen to a little bit of it every day on your walks. One thing I'm trying to do in this new year is just get back into listening to audiobooks more, because I used to be very hugely into audiobooks. A majority of what I read used to be audiobooks, and that's really how I was able to read upwards from like 50 to 75 to even 100 books one year. But I feel like in recent years, I just haven't been listening to audiobooks as much as I used to. And I'm trying to really bring that back. I feel like a lot of that time that I used to spend listening to audiobooks, I've been consuming social media. And so I really want to start replacing a little bit of my social media time and even just listening to music with listening to audiobooks, because while music is very therapeutic and I think good for the soul, I do think it is important to make time for things like listening to audiobooks and listening to podcasts, because those are really important to your development and your learning. So this one's a really, really good one. I highly recommend getting an Audible subscription if you want to get into audiobooks this year, just because you basically pay, I think it's like $7 a month for the most minimum basic subscription, and you get one audiobook a month. And I feel like having that one audiobook a month credit is really nice for just holding you accountable. The credits definitely roll over to the next month, so if you don't end up picking out a book for that specific month, your credits will definitely accumulate. But I feel like just having that like one credit a month gives you kind of a goal to at least listen to one audiobook a month. That's my rec of the week. So this episode is actually a conversation that I had with my friend Serin Khadr. She is the host of the podcast Journal Hijabi. I actually went on Journal Hijabi last calendar year, and we recorded an episode just kind of talking about my hijab journey, my Mauritanian identity. We talked about the Black Muslim identity. We honestly covered a lot in that episode, so I highly recommend you go give that episode a listen and just check out Journal Hijabi as a whole. I'll have her podcast linked in the show notes, as well as that episode that I was specifically on. But Journal Hijabi is a podcast that listens like a journal, in the sense that each episode is a new entry and each hijabi is an entry. Journal Hijabi tells the diverse stories of Muslim women globally. Journal Hijabi is one of my favorite podcasts that I listen to. I love just hearing all of the different perspectives of different Muslim women coming from different backgrounds, their hijab journey, their story, how they may have come to Islam, discussing a lot of the issues that Muslim women face on a daily basis. We talk a lot about like the negative representation in the media. And I think listening to Muslim women's voices is just a way to combat that and understand a little bit more of the experience, the daily experiences of Muslim women and how different they may be. So I love Journal Hijabi. I'm a huge fan of the podcast, and I think she has just such a stunning podcast Instagram. Like, I remember the first time I stumbled across the Journal Hijabi podcast Instagram, I was obsessed, and that's actually how I was first exposed to the Journal Hijabi podcast. So I'll also have the page linked in the show notes for you guys to go check out. Not only did we kind of discuss Serin's story and kind of discussed how Journal Hijabi came to be, but we also kind of discussed Muslim representation in the media. What exactly are the factors that have led to such negative representation for Muslims and Muslim women? We touched a little bit on Palestine. It was a really interesting conversation. Without further ado, let's go ahead and dive into this week's episode. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Disclaimers Aside. I'm so excited to have you on today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I feel like we had such a good conversation over on the Journal Hijabi, so I'm excited to just continue talking to you.
Yes, I'm so excited to be on Disclaimers Aside and chat with you more and further our conversation like we mentioned before.
Can you please introduce yourself to anyone who isn't familiar with Journal Hijabi and just give the audience a sense of like who you are?
My name is Serin. I am a Palestinian American from Texas, and I'm currently traveling in Spain. I have a bachelor's in social work that led me to found and lead the first menstrual student organization on campus, which brought free period products across bathrooms at our university and community shelters. Just 2 weeks ago, I graduated with my master's in educational psychology. And about 4 years ago, I started my podcast called Journal Hijabi, where we authentically discuss hijabi stories in mainstream media.
Congratulations on graduating with your master's. That's such a huge accomplishment.
Thank you. I know it was like a surreal moment. And it's like you only really feel it like when you go up the stage and walk it. But I will say there was less of a buzz to it than graduating with your bachelor's. You feel like everyone's there just for the bachelor's, really. And you're just like there just to like get the master's and then head home. Like people were leaving. Like you grab your master's, okay, bye, they did. So it's like interesting. But yeah, thank you. I mean, alhamdulillah, like I'm done with school.
Oh, so you're done at this point.
I mean, that's what I keep telling myself. And then these khaltos, they're like, oh, done in PhD, and like the PhD is next. And I'm like, oh my God, like that's like another 6 years. I don't know if I could commit, but I never say never. So I don't know what my future holds.
No, a PhD is a huge commitment. Like, I always have so much respect for people who can be in school for that long.
Yeah, and you have to be very passionate about a certain topic to be able to continue 6 years and write a dissertation and then do research. So, like I'm into things, but I'm like not that into things, to get a PhD. And I don't have any goal of becoming a professor anytime soon.
Yeah, exactly. But no, that's so amazing, and congratulations on getting your master's, and I hope you're enjoying your time in Spain. I feel like this is a great time, for you to just relax, explore the country. I feel like Spain is such a cool country, so.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Spain is very historic and has a lot of gems and Arab history. And we went to Granada and the Alhambra, and I laid down on a beach where Christopher Columbus took one of his voyages, which is just mind-blowing. Like every city you go to, anywhere you walk, there's just a story behind it, there's history behind it, and you really feel the authenticity because, Spain was one of the first colonizers in the world, actually, before British. And so they do have a lot under their belt that they, colonized, and, even Arabs and very violently in the past, and Andalusia. And then they have a history, they colonized California. And so coming here, you're like, oh my God, like, you know what? The right when I landed in the Sevilla airport, I was like, you know what? I feel like I'm in LA. I feel like I'm in Los Angeles because I took a trip to Los Angeles in August, and I saw right when I landed in the airport, I saw a Shell gas station next to palm trees, and in the background there were like hills and windmills and like yellow wildflower poppies, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is so California. And my sisters were laughing like, what do you mean LA? And then I was like, oh, well, of course, well, Spain colonized California, and there's a lot of similar names if you look at them. Like, it's really not Los Angeles, it's Los Angeles, and it's really not Santa Monica, it's Santa Monica. San Francisco, San Fernando, they're all San, which stands for like saints and stuff, and it just goes back to like Spain and the religion and a lot of his history. But yeah.
No, that's very incredible, and yeah, I'm sure there is a lot of history there. So, disclaimers aside, what is an unpopular opinion you have?
So I'm gonna be honest with you. I had to like sit on this one. I didn't like I tend to have a lot of unpopular opinions based on my two sisters, but it's like you don't really sit down and think about it. So I really had to think about it and look it up and like see something that's like in tune with me. An unpopular opinion that I have is that you should only use the word I love you in very rare times when you really, really mean it. I think people just throw that word around just like they're saying hi. And to me, it's very like sacred, and it only should be said when it's like 100,000% felt and you mean it. And I think that you shouldn't even use it a lot just to keep it so special. Like, you always say it in that moment. That's my unpopular opinion.
No, that's actually a really good one. And this reminds me of a conversation that I was having with my friends a few months back, where we were all kind of talking about how we perceive the phrase, I love you. And I realized that a lot of people overuse it, as you mentioned. Like, a lot of people just casually to their friends, even if there's not a huge, like, deeper connection that's been built over some time, we'll just use the phrase, I love you. I also agree with you. Like, I am definitely the type of person where it takes a lot for me to say I love you to a person. So they're really sacred words to me, and I feel like when I do use them, they become more special. But I think part of it too is, like, I feel like a lot of my relationship with this is, like, seeing kind of my culture and my family. Like, I feel like my parents are like not the most expressive when it comes to these types of things, but I feel like if you grow up in a whole household where that's used a lot more colloquially, then it becomes something that you're a lot more comfortable with using.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, kind of thinking about it in the cultural lens as well, like when it's kind of stigmatized in a household and it's not really said or expressed, that's when you start to develop like these thought processes about, well, okay, I'm gonna hold this word so dear to me and really use it when I mean it.
It's interesting to see how people have very different relationships with it.
It really mirrors our own trauma. And so I think that's why like we each have our own definition of it, because I will have, you know, a lot of my friends, like they'll just like you'll end a conversation and it'll be like, love you, I love you, love you. And I always like hesitate saying it because to me it's not a casual word, you know, it's a romantic word, not only just used with a partner, but any human, anything that you know you truly have admiration for.
No, I completely agree. So it is January, and I'm curious, what are some of your ins and outs of 2024? I don't know if you've seen this like TikTok trend where people are posting the things that they want to bring into the new year and the things that they kind of want to leave behind.
So I didn't see that trend. But around New Year's time, we took like a family trip, and like with our family and my sisters, some of my sisters' in-laws, and we sat around like this bonfire for like a couple of days. And so I did come across this very funny TikTok where a girl like she was like also at a bonfire, and they were like writing down things on a paper and then basically throwing them in the fire, basically things to let go. And one of the things that she wrote was broke people, you know, and then she just like cr crumbled it up and then threw it in the fire. And I don't know, I just thought it was funny. So I got that idea and then I like ripped the papers and like had pens and pencils and passed it around, and I told everyone, like my mom, my dad, and family, like, okay, what's one thing that you want to let go? And then just think about it and then just throw it in the fire. And like we were making jokes of like who's ever paper like lit the most or whatever. And my paper flew away from the fire. So I was like, man, I'm really it does not want to let go. And so just something that I remember from there is just kind of, you know, so the ins is to just let life run its course. Like whatever's happening is gonna happen. I'm done planning, I'm done like being the logistical person that I was. Just let life run its course. And then the outs are worries, guilt, and unhealed people.
I love that. I'm kind of on a similar page with you. Like, I feel like when I was planning for 2024 this year, I don't know if it was just because I had gone through like a period of burnout towards the end of this year, but I was at first when the new year hit, I was just so exhausted and it was really hard for me to sit down and actually like think about what I wanted out of 2024. And I was watching a YouTube video by this YouTuber Alicia Marie, and she was talking about how in 2023 one of the things that she did was let go. And it's funny how the moment she let go, so many amazing things happened in her life, whether that be her career or her social life, and she grew in a lot of ways when she stopped planning and she stopped worrying. So I definitely think that's such an important quality to have going into any new year. Like, you can make these plans, but you also have to just kind of, you know, let go and just allow Allah's plan to kind of come to fruition.
Yeah, I agree 100%. It feels so good to just let it happen. And I think for me, like I say it, but it has honestly been difficult because I always try to kind of be in control and I like for things to just work out in my favor. And for some reason, the past couple of months they have not. And it's like I only kind of let go when I reach rock bottom and the most worst possible thing happens. That's when I can let go and be like, okay, well, clearly it's not working in my favor. So, and then you realize, well, you didn't even have control to begin with, you know? So that's like interesting to kind of see.
Yeah. For people who aren't familiar with journal hijabi. Can you kind of just walk us through what it is and kind of what the mission behind journal hijabi is?
Yes. So journal hijabi is a cute little hobby. No, I'm joking. It's not a cute little hobby, but it kind of did start off like that. It really did start off as like a spark during midnight. It was the week before COVID happened. I was still in my bachelor's doing social work. It was the week before spring break, the week before no one went back to school and life was different. And so no one knew, there was going to be a shutdown. It was just the very beginning stages, just talking about it. And so I was just like in my room, randomly thinking and have like this burst of creativities. And I've always kind of been passionate about like storytelling and what I can bring from a cultural, societal lens geared towards hijabis and their voices, because I didn't see not only not much of that, but like none of that. And so I remember being on my phone like at midnight in my room the week before spring break, and I came across this ad. This was probably, I know it sounds crazy, but it was probably the very first ad that I saw that a hijabi in it. Like it was a hijabi that was like acting in the ad, and it was like a makeup ad. Right when I saw it, mind you, this was like 2020, which is like what, like 4 years ago, but it's crazy that for me at least, that was the first time that I came across an ad for a hijabi for a popular company, e.l.f. Cosmetics. I just kept replaying the ad and I actually screen recorded it because I guess it just wasn't posted to their page. Like it was just an ad, like, where you scroll like past Instagram stories and then an ad pops up. So that was going to be the only time that I could see it. And so the hijabi in there, she was just like so happy, so excited, smiling, playing with the makeup, jumping, wearing Doc Martens. And I'm like, whoa, 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 like, hello, like, where is this? We need more of this. And I just love the feeling that I had after seeing that ad. And then, boom, immediately, like an hour later, like I just started thinking and thinking, and I wanted to create something and like notes and names and all of this. So that's when I created the Instagram page, Journal Hijabi. And I had no idea what it was going to be, but all I knew is that it was just going to bring that same pump, that same feeling out into the world of hijabi empowerment and just happiness and fun, because I was so sick of the false narrative or the current narrative that has been going on for the past decade since 9/11, and we were put into this box, and it's like we were just like fighting for, I guess, the world just to see us like for who we are. And it's not like, we're trying to prove something, but we want to fix the false image because it's not fair for someone to speak on us and our religion for the past decade. And so it was kind of like taking the microphone back. And so it started turning into it turned into a podcast. So immediately I started like figuring out, okay, I'm creating a podcast. Do I know how? Absolutely not. But I figured it out. And then from then you have Journal Hijabi today, where I have some solo guests, but now some solo episodes, but now they're mostly guest episodes. And so it's continuing to grow. And I love the Journal Hijabi community and the Instagram page and the way it is now. And this is still just the beginning of it. And that is Journal Hijabi, a platform to spread the voices of diverse hijabis in mainstream media.
I think what is so incredible about the story behind Journal Hijabi is it really does show the importance of representation, the power of representation, especially for marginalized communities like the Muslim community. I think a lot of Muslim women, especially, can remember the first time that they saw like a Muslim hijabi in something like an ad. Like I remember for myself, I don't know what year it was, but I was walking through Target. And I saw this huge billboard of this like Muslim woman wearing hijab, and she was taking a video of like her young baby. And I remember I stopped with my mom in that Target, and I was so like my jaw dropped because I never thought I would see a Muslim woman displayed like that in a Target.
So I feel like it's like moments like that when Muslim women are humanized that can be so empowering. And I think what you've done with Journal Hijabi, really giving Muslim women the platform to share their stories, their experiences, and the diversity of, Muslim women across the world is so incredible.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, like you mentioned, it's crazy that some of us, it's like we see these ads and models and hijabis, and we're still so shocked. But it's like my goal is not to make it a shocking, groundbreaking thing that a hijabi is represented just like any other model, just like any other ad. That's my goal to normalize it.
One of the aspects that I personally really admire about Journal Hijabi is just how the episodes share so many different Muslim women's stories of hijab. So I would love to hear kind of what your hijab story was like.
Yes, so my hijab story, that was actually one of the very first episodes for Journal Hijabi that had like the most listeners, because it's a pretty interesting and funny hijab story. No one in the world that I know of has a hijab story like this, and it's very cool to hear different hijabi stories because we all wear the hijab. We know what it's about. We know what's written about it in the Quran and our religion and the values and the culture. But we each still have a very unique story of following up to that day of when you make that life-altering decision to wear the hijab. For me, this decision is kind of like in the back of every Muslim girl's mind of like, when I hit puberty, when I grow up, one day I'm going to start choosing to wear the hijab. And so for me, I didn't feel ready until what was it, like sophomore year of high school. Putting on the hijab was already a nerve-wracking experience as a young teenage woman in an American high school. It's already nerve-wracking. And so I wanted to kind of alleviate the experience as much as possible. In other words, rip the band-aid. So I literally ripped the band-aid, and the last week of my sophomore year in high school, I woke up and I started wearing the hijab on a random Friday and walked to the bus stop 6 a.m., rode the bus with my green olive pashmina hijab, and showed up just like that.
Wow. The last week of classes?
Yeah, the last week of sophomore year in high school.
No, that's brave. 'Cause I would have waited for the whole like the next school year or the summer.
Yeah, that's what people were saying, but I felt like my thought process was like, at the end of the school year, you're already familiar with the people, with the teachers, with your friends, with the vibe, right? You're so comfortable. It's the end of the year. You'll jump off the roof. You don't care. And so when you're already in that feeling, it's like you could do, whatever, like just put on the hijab, do new things, do like dye your hair blonde, If I would have waited, because some people mentioned that too, this was like my thought process. If I would have waited for the first day of junior year, that would have been double nerve-wracking. Like, I'm already nervous that it's the first day of class. I was even nervous the first day of my master's classes. Like, you just always have like this nerve. And so I didn't want to like double the nervousness of like, it's the first day of junior year and I'm wearing the hijab. No, so I wanted them to get used to it. Like, yeah, take it in now. Take it in now for this last week. This is who I am because next year I'm showing up. So that was my hijab story. And it was very humorous, funny, very welcoming, very understanding. I was just like walking in the halls. And although I went to an American high school in Texas, it was super diverse with a lot of Arabs and Muslims. And so a lot of people would like stop me and like, you're just like, hello, like, what is this? Like, they would laugh and be like, oh my God, like, congrats. And they would stop to take pictures and post me. Like, everyone was taking pictures with me. So I have a lot of pictures from my first day of when I wore the olive green hijab when I showed up on a random Friday. And so I think it's pretty cool to see. And actually, shortly after that, I saw other friends and girls in our high school and community wear the hijab. It was kind of like a ripple effect. So I guess I like really ripped off the hijab band-aid.
Wait, I really love that story. First of all, I love how supportive everyone is. Like, I love the fact that you low-key became a celebrity at your school and people wanted to take pictures with you. I also just love that it became a ripple effect and that you inspired other people to wear hijab. I feel like that's always so incredible to like have other people start wearing hijab because they were inspired by you. Like, it's truly such an amazing feeling and an amazing experience if you're afforded that opportunity. So that is such a cool like first hijab story, and I'm happy that you were able to like rip the band-aid off.
It worked out. So glad it did. And I just love that hijab story. Like I could say it over and over again. And like even when I mention it to the people that kind of experienced that day to me, like we'll just reflect back on that day and then just laugh. It's like a funny day known in Summit High School history.
You know what? I need a producer to listen to your hijab story and replicate that instead of all of those scenes that they love to show of these like self-hating hijabis in movies and TV shows.
Oh my God, literally say less. I need to be on the Today Show. Like we need our own true hijabi show. And you know, now that you've mentioned that is a huge thing that I mention a lot in Journal of Hijabi about the misrepresentations of, and I think we actually touched on it on my podcast too, a bit of like what were those shows? Like there's like this one show, it's actually based in Spain. Man, I don't know what.
Oh,
Oh, I think it's
Elite.
Hala. No, is it? Oh yeah, Elite.
Elite,
Elite, is it
yeah.
Elite? I think. And girl, please. It was like the basic, the most like replicated basic story of like, the actor. She was like wearing the hijab, and then she like took it off to be with the white guy, and the scene was like so cheesy and so sexualized. They just love to sexualize the hijab. They'll die if they can't capitalize off a woman's body and hijab. Like they'll just like itch their skin. So it was like a pool scene, and you know, like she's like getting in the pool with him, whatever. She slowly starts taking off the hijab. And then boom, she's immediately empowered and conquer the world and be with the white guy who left her the next week. So it didn't even matter that I took off my hijab for you because it didn't even matter. So it's just crazy that like they push these narratives in Netflix shows and Hollywood and movies, and it's an absolute sky. I mean, not as, it's an absolute shame that they do that, and it's not fair. And scam is what I was going to say. It's absolute scam due to hijabis.
It really is. And I really don't foresee things getting better until we get Muslim women in these roles, in these production roles where they're really at the forefront of the storytelling, where they can kind of share a little bit more of authentic experiences of like what it's like to actually be a Muslim woman that wears the hijab. So hopefully in our generation, like in the next 10, 20 years, things start to get better. I'm a very pessimistic person when it comes to this topic, just because I feel like the Hollywood is always like behind the publishing industry and like the literary industry. And I feel like when I'm reading books with Muslim representation, there's already still such a long ways to go. Things have definitely gotten better in the last 10 years, but there's still so much change that needs to happen when it comes to the Muslim representation we see in books. And so I just feel like Hollywood is even further behind that.
Yeah, so it's a pretty interesting but dark tunnel to really see through. The Hollywood industry is just really built on the capitalization of and sexualizations of women and the misrepresentation of Islam and hijabis. I always see these subtle hints. And I don't know if you've watched the Netflix movie called Leave the World Behind.
I haven't.
Yeah, you should. It's like I don't know, it's like everyone's like watching it and stuff, kind of like when that movie Bird Box came out. Like there's like these subtle like hints and messages, and of course they have to slip one about like Muslims in an Arabic language and make them look bad, like always. And I think there's always a reason for that. It's like, you say Hollywood and movies and representation, but it all goes it gets political, and it gets, it there's an agenda and there's war, and it's like it's huge, and it's not like, we're just sitting here and talking about like hijab and representation, but it really goes beyond of like the exploitation of Islam. And you mentioned, like more like writers and storytellers. This is the thing. I don't think that we have a lack of Muslim storytellers or hijabi storytellers or writers or actors or producers. I don't think so. I don't think that there's a shortage. It's just that we are all pushed towards one lens, and that is the Hollywood American Jewish lens that chooses the way that the world sees your story, because coincidentally, they are the ones that always have the huge TV networks, the huge news networks, the huge streaming networks, the huge social media networks. Coincidentally, it's owned by them. So they get to choose and operate how the world gets to perceive indigenous people and people of color and Muslims and diverse communities. And sometimes you have to be super careful, because although some of the things that you see, like brands or movies or TV shows, look like they're were being represented or diverse, but it's actually, there's like a word for it, I forgot. I think it's like token or something, tokenism, where they just like the diversity hire or whatever, like they use the image. But really, that company probably funds things that are like anti-hijab and anti-Islam. So that's something that I've been seeing recently, and you just have to be very careful about the intention. So, like to give you one specific example, today I saw this video. This girl was like walking across a Starbucks, and outside of it, on the glass walls, they have like a graphic design of hijabis, like hijabi cartoons holding Starbucks.
Oh, I
And
saw
it's
that.
so, yes. And so we all know the history and the leaders behind Starbucks, the corruptness. And it's like, when it really comes down to it, they will use diversity as a scheme. And you would think like, oh my God, like Starbucks is representing hijabis. Like, let's go. They love hijabis. But you're really funding literally things that are harming you and people that look like you. So in the end, it's like drinking poison. That's why they always hide behind diversity. You have to be very careful. And I think the only solution behind that is for Muslim creators and people of colors and indigenous communities and minorities and hijabis to be the ones at the forefront and to stand up and take their microphone and tell their stories and start their businesses and continue their ideas and be the ones that produce the stories and own them. Be the person that tells your story just the way it is. Stop handing it to these corporations and Warner Brothers and Netflix. Stop, letting them use your identity. You create your identity. We don't have a lack of Muslim people in hijabis. We just have a lack of people that own the corporations that give the platform for the world to see us.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. You are 100% correct. And I think it's so important when we're talking about what diversity looks like, what representation looks like, that we're looking beyond just what we see on a visual plane. It's like we have to be careful that we don't fall into tokenization. A lot of the times, marginalized communities so easily become tokenized by these large corporations that actually don't really care about the communities that they're pretending to support. And I think the Starbucks example is so indicative of that, because I remember seeing that. I think I saw it on TikTok where it was like they had a huge mural of hijabis, and it was funny because, it's after weeks and weeks of people boycotting because of their whole stance and their positionality in what's going on in Palestine. But it was just so hypocritical to see. It's actually comical that they think that people would actually fall for something like that.
Well, here's the thing. I also think it's scary because if the events that are going on right now in Palestine, the massacres, the genocide, the killing, the colonization, well, I mean, to be honest, we all know they've been going on, but like the most recent ones, the time that finally opened up people's eyes and ears after dying and being tortured and massacred for 75 years, it's like if that event didn't happen, and we were just walking randomly, and then you would see that people's reactions would have been differently because they didn't have that mindset that they have now. Their eyes were closed, they were blind to what that corporation was funding and doing and what it really stood for, their leaders. We would have hijabis would have posted it and be like, hell yeah, like Starbucks representation, let's go. You know, so it's like it's scary because you only know the truth of these corporations when you really, really, really dig deep. And sometimes it's so hidden that you never even know. And you're using something and drinking something that's literally killing your own people. So I think it's like it's hypocritical, but it's also scary too, because Starbucks isn't the only one. There's a lot that we just don't know because it's they're hidden. They're hidden.
That's a really good point. And I think something to be learned from this case specifically, too, is just to be conscious of what we're consuming. We live in such a hyper-capitalist society. And I feel like a lot of the times we just kind of consume products without really thinking about what are the implications, like where are we actually putting our money towards?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, kind of just to add to that, it's like me being here in Spain these past few weeks, it's like it's made me realize, like, you know, you say like capitalist society, but really it's just capitalist America because that's what it was built off of and that's what it's run on. And it's like these past few weeks here, like, I didn't have, you know, one thing that I'm used to. Like, let's say I was craving something, let me order an Uber Eats. There's no drive-throughs, there's no to-goes, there's no Ubers in the city. You have to walk places. It's like all of the things that were like luxury to me didn't exist here. And I was struggling, you know, and not even luxury, like the AC, like the basic AC that's on 24/7 in our houses. Like, you have to wear blankets and you have to pay extra electricity bill and you have to have an electric thing. So it's like it kind of really changes your mind and lens when you travel outside of the US. Hijabi representation, everything we just said about and the capitalization and the corruptness is really like just in the US. Like it happens elsewhere, but mainly like we see it a lot in the US. And to talk about like being very aware of like what you consume, I agree with that, but I will say it's also a struggle. You know, like I'm gonna be honest, like I'm still an American and I'm gonna go back to Texas, and there's gonna be a lot of things that I still don't support. And it's like sometimes you have no choice but to buy that thing or eat that thing because it's the only option. I think the issue here is to question our options. Why is like 90% of what I'm putting in my mouth supports a Zionist corporation, supports an anti is against Palestine? That's the real question that we should be asking. Why is it so hard for me to find something to eat or to drink or a website to use or Airbnb or to book a flight without it going back to killing of Palestinians, without it being going back to the harm of Palestinians and Muslims? That's the real question that we should be asking. And it's like here, like abroad, overseas, I don't know, Spain, that's not even, it's just crazy to see the comparison, because there's like no brand names, there's like no, you know, brand name food, there's no like brand name things. Like, you just get what you get, and like that's it is what it is. Like, it does the job at the bare minimum. And so it's just so crazy to see how consumed we are. But at the same time, I empathize with the lack of options and the struggle that you have to go to and the apps that you have to scan if you're sitting in a Walgreens to see if this horse to see if this Hershey's chocolate supports an anti-Palestinian cause.
Yeah, no, you bring up a great point. It really is about criticizing the larger structures that are behind this hyper-capitalist system. So, for people who kind of come from like a different background, maybe people that aren't really familiar about what it's like to be a Muslim woman, what are some misperceptions that you've kind of observed over the years that people a lot of the times have about the hijab?
So I think like in the beginning of creating this podcast, it was kind of the basic lens and idea that people had about hijabis that we essentially don't know what we're doing. We don't know why we wear something on our head. Kind of sort of this there's like a certain word for it, demoralizing, something like that. Lens that they had of like who does she who like what is she doing? You know, kind of like the silliness of like why are you wearing that? It's so hot. Why do you wear that? Blah blah blah. Like, do you even know? Like, you're too young. So that was kind of the misperceptions. And I think nowadays there definitely is a lot less than that, because I think as a society we have matured and we have grown, and there's more people that know about the hijab than people who don't, except like in small towns that have no idea what it is. And so I think the misperceptions have lessened, but I think a certain it's like hard to say without like using specific words, but I think there's always a certain group of people run by the media that is always going to push the anti-hijab view, and it's really goes back to the anti-Islam view. So it's like I'm one person fighting this right, but it's like no matter, and we've just seen in this world, no matter how much you fight it, I will tell you there will always be anti-hijab and anti-Islam people. Like, it's not going to be resolved. It just is. Why? I don't know. Because first in some way we are a threat to them. We are one of the most powerful religions in the world. There's something so just unique and interesting to be able to cover up in modern times and be modest and be a hijabi and show up as you are. There's something cool about that, apparently, and something very powerful about it too, for it to even have misconceptions to begin with.
I completely agree. And I don't know where I heard this. I don't know if it was a podcast or I saw it on TikTok, but someone was talking about how a lot of the fear around Muslims in American society is not only are Muslims the fastest growing religion, but when you think about it, a lot of what makes American society and like the West so appealing, or the things that kind of entrap people in the West. Muslims, because of the discipline that Islam is built on, don't really fall for it. Or, like, it's hard for us to be entrapped by it. And I think that's where a huge fear comes from when it comes to seeing Muslims grow or seeing Muslim women, for example, because they are the most visible of Muslims, reach these places or kind of get to a level where they're just seen more, they're more visible. I think that's where a lot of the fear of that comes from. Even just, the idea of the Muslim woman finding liberation outside of taking off clothes and like sexualizing a woman's body, that goes against kind of some of the values of Western society, and that is kind of a threat to that. So I think I definitely see that direct clash of a source of where some of that fear comes from.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. There was also this this saying that's been going around that Palestine is actually the only country that's free, because we are free from the blindness of freedom. We are the ones that are fighting corruptions, the only ones that can see through this and that are not falling for it, the capitalist ideologies and societies and certain ways and modernization and just certain ways that the world wants us to be, but we're actually free because we're the only ones that aren't falling for it. We're the only ones that are brave enough to even fight it off, to fight off this corrupt ideology and corporation and organization that is behind a lot of the suffering of human beings in this world.
No, I definitely agree. That reminds me of something that one of my professors last semester told us. She was talking about how, like, the only way to truly be free or to understand freedom is to understand unfreedom. You can't understand freedom without understanding what it truly is to be unfree.
That's a good one. I mean, it really speaks deep to me now, thinking about Muerte's words about, like, you think you are free people, like the free people of America. No, you're not free because you don't even have the power to stop the killing of people. You don't even have, we don't even, we aren't the free people of America. We don't have power in Congress. We don't have power in the White House. We don't have power anywhere. So we aren't free. You really think about it. We're not free. Our only food options are corporations like Walmart and other corporations and Coca-Cola that fund the very same thing that's harming us. So are we really free? No. To be honest, I think we're in a cage, and that is the United States of America. And yes, I live there. And yes, that's still a place that I will always call home because I was raised there and born there. But I am also vigilant that truly we are not the free people. We are not a free country, truly.
Yeah, no, that's the illusion of American exceptionalism, is this idea that we are the freest country in the world, but really, what's going on behind the scenes? What did we have to do to create this country? How what are we doing currently around the world globally to prop up this American society?
Yeah, and to also ask the question, like, who's really in charge? Who's really the one that's running this country? Because it's clearly not the people. The people are the majority, but we still, in some way, like, we don't have the power that we think we have, that we were told we have, that was written in the Declaration of Independence. So I don't know if it started with George Washington or some snake kind of snuck in throughout the years after 1776 and started playing with the rules. And so, I mean, I don't know. I've just about had it, but.
How has starting Journal Hijabi really changed your perspective on the hijab?
So, kind of answering that question from today's perspective, it's changed my view of hijab. My view of the hijab has changed ever since I started this podcast because it's given me the time and the resources to really sit down and research what the hijab is and what it means. And there's a lot of information about there that brings you back to the core of the hijab, back to who first wore it in like the 600s BC or something like that, AD. So it's like it's changed. It hasn't changed my view of the hijab. It's expanded my view of the hijab. Every day I get to, it's kind of like getting a PhD in hijabi history, to be honest, if that's a thing. I already did it. So yeah, I mean, kind of going back to that question, like it's expanded my view of the hijab, and it continues to expand it.
For a lot of us, we kind of grapple with it maybe before we decide to put it on, but we don't really take the time to research the hijab and learn the history and really just understand it from a level beyond our own experiences. And so I think that's amazing that you got the opportunity to really research the hijab and understand the hijab through so many different lenses.
Yeah, I mean it's a joy to do, and it's something that I feel like it's not only a passion, but it's like a calling for me. So I love that I get to do it.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for, joining me for today's conversation. I feel like we talked about so many important topics today. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Where can the listeners find you on social media? And of course, I'll have all of these platforms linked in the show notes for the listeners to follow.
Yeah, so they can find me, Sidine, personally on the Instagram at Sidine Qadir, SereenQuader. And then they can follow a Journal Hijabi page that posts everything about the podcast and podcast clips and reels at Journal Hijabi. That's JOURNAL Hijabi, HIJABI.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having me. I think this conversation was very needed, and I kind of went off the rails and got a bit too passionate, which I love about podcasting. But yeah, thank you for having me. I loved coming on.
So I hope you guys enjoyed this week's episode. As usual, make sure to check out the show notes for all of the links that we mentioned in this week's episode. Make sure to follow Sirin and Journal Hijabi on all of the mentioned social media platforms. And if you're not already, make sure to subscribe to this podcast and follow the Disclaimers Aside podcast Instagram. It's really just a space to extend a lot of the conversations that we have here on the podcast in more of an accessible and community-oriented format. With that, I will chat with you guys in my next episode. Bye.